I said that I've just started here. I've just finished a PhD working with Pedro Ferrer in the UK, working on cosmological consequences by theories of gravity, of which this was one of them. And I just thought it would be interesting to give a quickish review of this, because I think unique amongst modified gravity models, this one's been compared against the kind of precision tests which have, well, worked in favor of general relativity tradition. So here's the action for the theory. It's a somewhat unfortunate name, but it's not inaccurate. So basically, it's a theory of the dynamical preferred frame. So it's a constraint in the action using a Lagrange multiplier field, which enforces a fictional constraint in the vector field, and so it's chosen to be unit time-like. And then following this, you just construct the most general timing two derivatives possible. So that introduces four constants into the theory. So in principle, well, you might imagine, well, there's no symmetry to stop these constants taking, you know, any value. So the only thing really to do is to look at what these do, you know, in a physical system, and then compare against what we actually seem to see. Okay. So as it stands, this is probably the simplest generally covariant model of Lorentz violation. And so it's useful in the sense that if you see kind of problems emerging in this, it might be indicative of problems that might be quite pervasive to this kind of approach. And also, this field itself is quite widely used in a variety of kind of phenomenological modified gravity models, mainly to do with making a relativist version of this Mond idea. So it's three from there. So it's interesting to see kind of hazards that might emerge just through using. Okay, so I guess the kind of the classic backyard test of general relativity is the PPN analysis. And so the basis for that is you consider kind of a test particle motion in space-time, which is Minkowski small corrections. So you can imagine, right, so the branching for that will kind of have a term like 1 minus the Newtonian potential, a v-squared term, velocity squared, and you're interested in the kind of next corrections up to that. And it turns out that in appropriate gauge corrections, the G00, G0i, and GIJ are order 2, 3, and a half, 1 respectively. Okay. And so the kind of PPN ansatz is that, for instance, these metric terms can be expressed in terms of sums of functionals such as these. So you've got these constants A1 and A2, which weigh them. And so to be expected, or hoped, or other gravitational theory can be described by unique values for these numbers, A1, A2, and so on. Okay. And fortunately, too, this ansatz turns out to be suitable for the Einstein-Ether model. The two papers have carried out this analysis in part and before. So for instance, to Newtonian order, you just get what looks like a normal Newtonian Poisson equation, but there's a rescaling here due to C1 plus C4, and I'll kind of use this notation throughout, so it can double index under C or triple means the sum of those coefficients. And so as long as compared to belief that kind of the raw value of G in the action is not the value we observe, but rather we observe Gn, which is this raw value, this factor 1 over 1 plus C4, 1, 4 over 2. So if that's what's happening, then all the PPN parameters are identical to GR, except for these two so-called third frame constants, alpha 1 and alpha 2. So explicitly, alpha 1 is given by this, which is a kind of rough and messy combination of the C parameters. It's kind of vision into what that does. So if you look at a near circular orbit, it'll introduce a correction to the acceleration, which is given by this, and W is the velocity of the system you're looking at with respect to the preferred frame, V is the object's velocity, and R will be its kind of radial distance from a spherical symmetric source. So what this does is it introduces kind of radial oscillations of the orbit, and this is rather tightly constrained by looking at the orbit of the moon, by lunar laser ranging data, and so the answer is kind of consistent with zero, but the appropriate bound is about 10 to the minus 4. The next number, alpha 2, is also non-zero, and again, it's even messier function. But the effect's a bit more subtle. So what happens is, so if you consider an oblate spinning celestial body with respect to the preferred frame, we'll tend to experience a torque around that. We'll preset the spin axis around that preferred frame. What you actually observe is very kind of, well, it's a very small angle between the sun's rotation and the angular momentum of the solar system, or the normal to the ecliptic. And so it's very tight bound indeed on this number, alpha 2. Okay, so this would look like a big trouble for the theory already. If these C's were of order unity, then you know you kind of expect directions comparable to the strength of gravity, but here it's looking like right off the bat they should be about 10 to minus 7 or something like that. But as it happens, you can actually find two constraints within the parameter space, which makes the ppm parameters identical to general relativity. More on that later.
So do you think all ppm parameters capture all the solar system tests that are possible?
Today, it's not true.
I don't know, because that just have a parameterization is not necessary. It's not the real world.
I'm not aware of a test that hasn't been successful in terms of these parameters. I might be wrong. Okay, so Jacobson and Mattingly in 2004 actually looked at the kind of wave spectrum that you get from this theory. And so it turns out that you, in addition to the, well, so you keep the kind of usual tensor modes from their relativity, but their speed is not necessarily unity. And in addition, you get get two vector modes and a scalar, right, which is what you expect as a 3 degrees of freedom for a fixed non-vector field. Okay, and so this is might turn out to be a rather important point, that the speed of the waves, with, so this is all done with respect to the preferred frame, it's not necessarily unity. Okay, so the next thing you can then do, by the way, I mean, this is a basic thing. You require that these square speeds be positive and not negative, otherwise all these perturbations are exponential, unstable values. Okay. So then Ewing and 06 calculated the average energy density of these plane wave solutions calculated over the cycle. So they're always positive for tensor modes, not necessarily positive for vector modes, and not necessarily positive for scalar modes. But again, it's a region of the parameter space, so that it is positive for all of the extra modes that you create. So this is rather important because it enables you to start looking at the kind of the emission of energy from something like a binary pulsar system. So if you choose those two constraints mentioned earlier, that give the ppm parameters as identical to GR, then, well, quite surprisingly, the radiation due to a binary pulsar when you ignore strong fields is actually only from the quadrupole moment or component, just as in GR, but it's actually a different rate. So this is a very complicated function again. It's confirmed to within about 0.01% accuracy for the binary pulsar PSR 1916+13. So as long as this constraint is satisfied, then it's identical to GR, although they say the probable correction is for a stronger field system. Okay. So this is the totality of the constraints on the parameter space just from kind of smallish scale physics. And what you have, so originally a kind of unlimited 4D parameter space, you're left with a kind of 2D surface, and of that there's a single line which satisfies the binary pulsar constraints. Right, so this entire shaded region satisfies the stability, the positivity of energy of the plane waves, and ppm constraints.
There are also constraints on Lorentz violating theories that have nothing to do with G.
One's coupled to matter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so from
is this consistent with those tests also?
No. This is not coupled to matter. Mm-hmm.
Well, he has to couple it to matter.
Ah.
Well, is there no matter in this theory? I mean,
oh, sorry. Well, right, so in principle you could have couplings between the vector fields and the standard model fields.
You need to, don't you? I mean, there's no symmetry that forbids those couplings. So
right. They have to be very small, but just as a phenomenological thing, the guys who created this were just looking at it in the gravitational sense. But I agree, I mean, that. So those coefficients have to be very small to be. Okay, so basically, right, so this is the kind of surviving parameter space, if you like. So in cosmology, well, almost by analogy of the Poisson equation and the Friedmann equation, you then get kind of rescaling of the gravitational constant. But if you're sticking to the region that satisfies the PPM constraints, then alpha is equal to, alpha C1 plus 3, C2 plus C3, that's automatically equal to minus C1 minus C4. So the locally measured value of G is equal to the cosmological G. And so if you have kind of the constituents you expect from the cosmological model, the expansion history will be no different. How are we doing for time?
Doing well.
Okay.
So you have, I think, half an hour or something. Yeah.
Really?
You don't have to use it.
Okay. So Eugene Lim in 2004 and Lee Motter and John Barrow in 2008 worked out the primordial power spectrum. So in the case of a single scalar field interton plus gravity plus this vector field. So the result is that the tensor primordial power spectrum is necessarily diminished in comparison to the value you expect from just the absence of the vector field, which is P tilde. And by the constraints which define the shaded region, so these numbers have to be less than zero. So you have less chance of finding gravity waves. As for the, so phi is the trace perturbation in the conforming Newtonian gauge. So as for the comparison between P, what you expect with the ether, and P tilde, what you expect without the ether, it's actually identical to GR because, identical to the absence, with the absence of the ether because this, again, this relation C1 4 equals minus alpha. Okay, yes, identical.
Is there any implication of the vector modes in this?
See. I think it was worked out in this paper by Lim, but I'm not sure what bearing it might have.
I don't know, I'm just thinking like human V modes or something. I haven't got any idea in mind. I mean, the difference, normally you don't have vectors because there are no physically propagated vectors. But here you have two, I think you said you have two vector modes, is that right?
Yeah. I might be wrong here, but I think they might actually be washed out by being on an inflating background element.
Even when they go outside the horizon, is that still true?
So I think on the super horizon, this is the game.
So why are there two vector modes? I mean, you started with one vector field. You started with one vector field.
Right.
So what?
Did you just mean two polarizations? I think you said
two
polarizations. I see.
Okay. So the next thing is to compare this to precision cosmology, the CMB structure formation. So the easiest thing to do is work in the synchronous gauge. As for expanding the vector field, so the fixed norm constraint dictates that the zero components of the vector field should just be equal to one. And it'll, however, in general, it can have a spatial perturbation that might grow. And it just so happens that it's easier to use this variable when working out these equations. So this is some work that I did with Joe Zunks and Pedro Ferreira. So these are Einstein's equations. And as you can see, there's a tracking component due to the vector field, which isn't necessarily the same, but again, because C1 is minus alpha, it's the exact same effect. And you just have a source term in the key there, and also in this equation. And basically, just because we've used the shear equation in writing this, and so you pick up almost an effective. And it's on the shear due to the other fluids in the universe. Okay, and again, well, the vector field equation looks horrible, but in this parameter space, it satisfies PPM constraints. Again, C14 equals minus alpha, so this disappears, this disappears, this disappears. Essentially, this field C is only sourced by the anisotropic stresses of the neutrinos and the photons in the universe.
Physically speaking, so I mean, this C14 equals minus alpha choice. I mean, is there an easy way to understand what physically that corresponds to in the model? And like, I mean, you just said that it means that there's just a coupling to the anisotropic stress. Is that it's just you're just limiting the effect? I mean, it seems like this is a magic, not a magic choice, but like really a key choice that really kills a lot of the possible effects in your model and also makes it fit data better. So is there some easy way to see why?
No, I mean, so if you just look at the action, I mean, it's not obvious that this choice leads to something special, but it seems that again and again, so whenever there are tracking turns, you know, so you'll see the same tracking of, well, same rescaling of Newton's constant across the board, whereas we're looking at, and I don't know, I mean, because, so they, I mean, the choice, so if you chose C2 equals 0, C4 equals 0, and C1 plus C3 equals 0, you just have the kind of Maxwell kinetic term, and that would be the one you might expect off the top of your head to be the most simple behavior, and, you know, perturbations not being sourced by the metric so much, but I'm not sure.
I guess it's not an easy way to understand. It's just,
I mean, well, for instance, too, so there is an anisotropic stress due to this vector, and that is proportional to C1 plus C3, but it's hard to get a vision of, you know, exactly what's going on there. Okay. So, with a view to kind of restricting that shaded region further, we modified CMB easy to accommodate these modified evolution equations. And use cosmo-MC to kind of search around the shaded region for the best of the cosmological data. And we allowed for cold dark matter, usual standard model cosmology. Okay. So, these are results. As you can see, the effect on the UK is virtually non-existent. If you look closely, there's a tiny difference on smaller scales. But really, I mean, so I should say this is across the dotted line that satisfies the weak pulsar constraints. And so the virtually non-existent constraint up and down that line. However, in terms of the CLs, there is an effect here. It becomes progressively worse. So C plus is increased. C plus is C1 plus C3. So this is the plot we get to the end. So this is the output really of the MCMC process. So somewhat bizarrely, so we let it search off the entire shaded region. The best fit to the data, well, so here's lambda CDM with all the C's plus 0. The best fit's actually over here. But I don't think it's fair to say it's all of this favors the universe with this kind of vector field, because we've increased the parameter number by 2, and we increased the fit by about 2 sigma.
What kind of data sets are you using?
Oh, yeah, sorry. So we used SDSS, WMAP, 5-year, I think, and supernova data.
This is galaxies.
Yeah.
Sorry. LRGs.
I think so.
If it mattered, it looks like you need to worry about nonlinear bias. If you're using all the scales in that figure. But if the models don't predict differences, I guess it doesn't matter. Does the galaxy constraint do anything?
So, going to this one again.
Yeah.
There's what about C minus? C sub minus? Does that also have no effect?
You say basically, so what we're doing is moving up this line here. So C minus is a function of C plus.
Oh, I thought you explored the whole shaded region.
Ah, sorry. As far as this plot goes, yes, but for these ones in particular,
but it's relevant for the second plot, what C minus does to be okay, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think in fact that what ends up from the field equations is that, so H, the trace perturbation, is sourced not at all by the vector field. And so, you know, I guess that's what you're worrying about in terms of the dark matter. So it doesn't notice that.
Yeah, so the delta, so the delta chi squared of your fit is 2?
Sorry, I mean, so this is the best fit, and so this is what it spits out as being 1 sigma and 2 sigma.
But I mean, the law of likelihood change, do you have something else?
Off the top of my head.
But can I ask, but this line, right? What was the origin of this line between C plus and C minus?
This line?
Yes.
Oh, sorry. So this is the line for which the radiation emission from a binary pulsar is exactly equal to general relativity.
Okay, so yeah, you want to be very close to that line then.
Ah, yeah. So that's confirmed to say within 0.1%. Mm-hmm. So you should really be thinking about deviations in the C's of order. One over 1,000, something like that. And again, so deviations from its surface in the orders of 10 to the minus 7, because that's the constraint on item 2. Okay. Yeah. So basically, you can see that this fit is certainly unacceptable for C plus is about 1.9. So originally started with basically an unlimited 4D parameter space, and solely in solely in trying to look as close to lambda CDM universe as possible, it's been restricted more or less to like just on this single line or very thin tube. So this model is being subjected to an impressive range of constraints and spanned 15 orders of magnitude in doing so. Right, so this line survives, but it's a deeply complicated expression. So it's constraint dimensions, A equals 1. And you can solve that for 1C in terms of others. So that's how the model does when compared to the data.
Surprising to be back on a schedule. So, questions? Questions. So this is interesting. So you're saying, so this is just the effect of vector modes or vector trivial freedom, or is it?
Oh, no, so this is just the scalar modes.
These are just the scalar modes. The vector modes don't do anything.
Okay.
The scalar modes don't do much.
But they're super limited.
Yes, actually. So I should say that, right? So this survives, but in staying on the line, all these modes are super limited.
How superluminal?
Yeah. Well, I mean, pretty superluminal.
Yeah, I mean, if it has been like 10 times speed of light, 100 times speed of light.
So,
just a little bit. But the CMB frame that we have.
I have a question. Why would it matter how superluminal?
Wow, I just wanted that. but let me ask, get an answer. But then we can discuss that. Do you know what's the speed of? I guess you had expressions for a speed of sound.
Yeah. So the speed of the spin 2 perturbations is going to be, what's this? 1 over 1 plus C plus.
Mm-hmm. 1 over 1 plus C plus. And C plus is negative. So it's going to be like 2, 3,
something like that.
Okay. I see. That's interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, perhaps this is not completely finish it off. Mm-hmm. The problems you get with superluminal modes.
Yeah.
So you only used a value map from the same group?
Let's see. Actually, I think it's, to be fair, I think it's several data sets. So,
okay. Given the shape of the models you had, you might benefit from throwing in some more.
Yeah.
Right, but if you already have, then that's the point.
Yeah, so we explore it.
So maybe this is a CBI access, I think. Okay.
Well, I mean,
I also would be kind of yes. Or a string problem. Mm-hmm. But you prefer negative C plus, right?
Forced to.
Yeah, forced to, yes. So that means you get an excess compared to lambda CDM, right? Because that positive C plus seems to be lower than Is that correct?
Well, the point is that he's doing a full reparameter fitting. So you presumably you changed all your cosmological parameters and right? So you
They're free to vary.
Okay. So presumably it'll look just like the other map. It's just you'll change an acid. Do you happen to know what other parameters change in your best fit? Like what has to change to get your?
I have a table in the paper that I can show.
Sorry.
Okay. Well, if there's no more questions this time, come again.